I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this is a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 9. In February of 1897, the composer-conductor Gustav Mahler made a bold career move. Born Jewish, he converted to Catholicism in order to become the director of the Vienna Court Opera. For the next 10 years, he would relentlessly reform and improve the orchestra, singers, and production values of the company. For 10 years, Mahler toiled ceaselessly, and not even his greatest detractors, of whom there were many, could deny that the quality of operatic and symphonic performances was drastically improved. However, by 1907, Gustav Mahler was done. He could no longer endure the constant anti-Semitism of the music critics, tendered his resignation, and accepted a lucrative contract from the Metropolitan Opera in New York. There were two other significant tragedies that occurred in the summer of 1907. The first was the death of his daughter Maria Anna from diphtheria. Ironically, Mahler had written his song cycle Kindertotenlieder, songs on the death of children, 3 years earlier. One can only imagine the composer's horror of seeing his own musical thoughts expressed in such a real and personal way. The final tragedy of the summer of 1907 was that Mahler learned that he had a serious heart condition. His doctors were very concerned and strongly advised him to avoid the physical exercise he enjoyed so much. Mahler had always taken great pride in his physical condition and loved cycling, hiking, and swimming, all of which were now forbidden. Mahler made his New York debut on New Year's Day of 1908 with Wagner's Tristan und Isolde. After a successful season, he returned to Austria for a quiet summer of rest and composition. Having suffered so much in the summer of 1907, he could not return to his usual country house in Meiernich and asked his wife Alma to find a new place. She found a large farmhouse in the town of Toblach in the Dolomites, and it was there that Mahler would spend his final 3 summers composing. In 1908, he wrote Das Lied von der Erde, in 1909, the Ninth Symphony, and in 1910, the unfinished Tenth. While the Ninth Symphony was the composer's last completed work, it's not his actual Ninth Symphony. Mahler, already obsessed with death and nervous about his own mortality, refused to call Das Lied von der Erde, a Mahlerian symphony in all but name, his Ninth. Mahler was very superstitious about writing a Ninth Symphony, was well aware that Bruckner died before completing his Ninth, and that Beethoven only completed 9 symphonies. Perhaps Mahler felt safe enough, having named his actual Ninth Symphony something other than a symphony, that he could now name his Tenth his Ninth. If this makes your head spin, here is the chronology. Mahler 8th Symphony of 1000, Song of the Earth, Mahler 9, Mahler 10 Unfinished. Sadly, all the numerical machinations were in vain, as Mahler never saw the summer of 1911, dying just weeks shy of his 51st birthday. Though Mahler's Ninth Symphony is written in the conventional 4 movements, there is nothing conventional about it. Lasting between 70 and 80 minutes, it consists of 2 outer slow movements with 2 inner faster movements. If you're looking for some symphonic precedent for this idea, look no further than Tchaikovsky's 6th Symphony, The Pathetique. It too begins with a slow movement, has a dance movement for its second, an enthusiastic allegro march for its third, and an adagio for its 4th. Mahler was not a big fan of Tchaikovsky's music, but he did conduct the 6th Symphony by Tchaikovsky a number of times towards the end of his life. Perhaps something rubbed off. To the music, mes petits amis. Mahler's enormous first movement is marked andante comodo, roughly translated a comfortable walking pace. For a work with a huge orchestra, Mahler begins with the most economical of forces, 2 horns, 2 harps, cellos, and violas. In these 20-some seconds, and even before presenting the first theme of the symphony, Mahler gives each of the 4 instruments a crucial theme. First, the cellos and the horn combine to repeat the note A. It uses a strange, halting rhythm. Thank you. Walter, Mahler's first great disciple, felt that this rhythm reminded him of Mahler's halting gait. Leonard Bernstein famously said that this portrays the rhythm of Mahler's faulty heart. Whatever it portrays, I'm pretty darn sure that irregular rhythms that are scored for hollow-sounding instruments are disturbing, whereas regular rhythms are comforting. Next, there is the harp. Its motive is a tiny arch going up and down. The horn motive is also an arch, but it uses larger intervals than the harp, fitting snugly over it and complementing it well. Finally, there is the viola, which has a six-note oscillation with the interval of a third. That's an astonishing amount of information in a short amount of time, but if we have these ideas in our heads, an amazing experience awaits us. Theme 1 begins in the second violins and is one of Mahler's simplest and most beautiful melodies. It features a two-note descending idea. As I mentioned earlier, Mahler used his summers to compose, and the rest of the year was occupied with earning a living conducting. The previous summer, 1908, Mahler was busy writing Das Lied von der Erde, an hour-long song symphony. The final 30-minute movement is called Der Abschied, the farewell. The last few bars end with the words ewig, or forever, and are set to the same melody as the beginning of the first theme of the ninth. So Mahler literally picked up one composition where he left off another. It's worth quoting the words from Das Lied von der Erde at this point, because I believe it gives us a pretty good idea of what Mahler is thinking about in this movement. I'll never wander far, still is my heart awaiting its hour. The dear earth everywhere blossoms in spring and grows green anew. Everywhere and forever, blue is the horizon. Forever, forever. Simple, direct, hypnotic, repetitive, beautiful. We would love to stay here all day, but this is Mahler, and tragedy is never far away. Suddenly, the music changes character as Mahler prepares to introduce us to his second theme idea, which is a rather odd-sounding waltz-like melody. Then we hear the second theme in all its frightening fury. all is not lost, at least yet, Mahler repeats theme one with a most beautiful, rich orchestration. Now that Mahler has exposed us to his thematic material, he ends the exposition with a fantastic climactic moment. But this triumphal moment is followed by our irregular heartbeat rhythm idea, now played by some very angry brass. Also note that the timpani is playing the harp motif, and that the beautiful two-note descending idea, which was used in the beautiful first theme, is now brutal and sneering. It seems that Mahler is telling us that death is never far away. There's a long development section where Mahler fragments his two themes, and we move from music that is almost silent to heroic and frightening climaxes. Here is a beautiful deconstruction of elements from his two themes. First, theme two in the brass, and then the two-noted idea from theme one in the saddest guise possible. Meanwhile, after what sounds like a recapitulation of his themes, Mahler gives us the fiercest version yet of the heartbeat rhythm. This leads to a classic patented Mahler funeral march. Later, we get a restatement of theme one as a funeral march. Mahler loved funeral marches and used them in most of his symphonies. In fact, his first piece of music written at age seven was entitled Polka and Funeral March. Finally, the struggle is over, and we are at peace, courtesy of a beautiful solo violin and other solo instruments playing the beautiful two-note motive. Thank you. We started the movement with almost nothing, and we end with nothing. Our journey from dust to dust. If Mahler's music for the first movement is spiritual, his music for the second movement is purely corporeal. We leave the city and head out to the country for one of Mahler's favorite dances, the Austrian Ländler. The Ländler is considered the forerunner and perhaps the country cousin to the waltz. Like the waltz, the Ländler is in triple time, but a slower version and, dare I say, a bit earthier. And in the case of this movement, clumsier. Mahler composed in the Austrian countryside and probably heard these melodies performed by local people. Mahler often felt like an outsider. He was a bohemian in the Austrian Empire, a Jew in a Catholic world, and an erudite city dweller writing music in the countryside. Mahler said that the music should be played at the pace of a leisurely country Ländler, somewhat dull and very rough. In this enormous dance movement, we have a medley of three Ländlers. The first begins with a rather silly bassoon, which is playing the simplest upward scale in C major, a slightly snarky clarinet, and the bagpipe-like drones. Ländler 2 is a faster, more sophisticated, rather angular affair. Like Mahler, it seems a bit too sophisticated for its rural surroundings. When Mahler brings back the first Ländler, it seems to have caught the fast tempo of the second. Listen here as Mahler has the horns play the scale the bassoon just played, pushing the horns almost beyond the capacity of their instruments. This is nuts. This polite Ländler is now way out of control. For the third Ländler, things dramatically slow down, and the dance begins with a two-note sighing motive from the last movement. Here is the second iteration of Slow Ländler 3, which, though strikingly beautiful, still seems to have a bit of an edge. Then we welcome back Ländler 1, but it's gotten a bit snarkier and weirder. Like the first movement, this movement ends with Mahler deconstructing his Ländler instrument by instrument until there is almost nothing left, leaving us with a question: is this good humor or satire? The fact that we end with piccolo and contrabassoon might indicate the latter, but I'm okay with both. Mahler called the third movement of the symphony a rondo burlesque. Rondos are pieces that are based on departure and return of musical material, and burlesque, well, something that is broad, humorous, and perhaps a bit vulgar. Mahler inscribed the music to my brothers in Apollo. We are pretty sure that this refers to the many Viennese music critics that berated him during the decade he was music director of the Vienna Court Opera. Not only were the critics abusive of Mahler's music, they were also anti-Semitic, and in this they were encouraged by the city's mayor, the populist Karl Luger. If you think I'm exaggerating the situation, Karl Luger's form of populism was one of the inspirations for his fellow Austrian Adolf Hitler. It's important to point out that during Mahler's life, his fame and frankly fortune was based not on his compositions, but on his conducting. His fellow Viennese often found his symphonies overlong, overwrought, and vulgar. While Mahler knew that the critics were mostly musically uneducated hacks, he was nevertheless hurt and angered by their reviews. One of the most unjust and frankly ridiculous criticisms leveled against Mahler by his critics was that he had no knowledge of counterpoint. Counterpoint is the ability to present multiple melodies at one time. This movement, which is incredibly dense and immensely contrapuntal, it even contains a double fugue, is the composer's way of sticking it to the man. Let's return to the epithet "to my brothers in Apollo." Does this sound particularly fraternal to you? Finally, out of what is an extreme amount of counterpoint, an actual theme emerges in the strings, which sounds like a fugue. This leads to a section where Mahler references a very popular chorus from Franz Lehár's Merry Widow. Premiered in 1905, it was, and is, immensely popular. This is the music the Viennese had no problem understanding. It must have frustrated Mahler enormously. As this is a rondo and things are based on departure and return, without any warning, the fugue and contrabundal craziness are back. And then, once again, this being a rondo, we're back to Lehár. But it's a bit more bitter than before. For the final presentation of the fugue, Mahler goes all out and gives us a double fugue. One fugue subject is in the horns and the other in the cellos. Take that, Viennese musical establishment. Even Mahler's anger isn't exhaustible, and from the double fugue emerges this melody on the trumpets. Mahler is going to try awfully hard to get this music to a beautiful pastoral place, but it just doesn't work. The angry music of the opening returns, and the music ends like this. Now, before we go to the transcendent adagio that is the final movement, we have to have one more listen to the beautiful pastoral melody in the middle of the third movement. Pay close attention to the four-note turn idea, because it's going to be important. And here's the music that opens the final movement, adagio. This leads us to the principal theme for the movement, which might sound familiar to some of you. If this reminds you of the hymn, Abide With Me, you are not alone. The next question is where Mahler might have heard it. Certainly not in Catholic Austria, where Protestant hymns are scarce. Could Mahler have heard this music during his time in the United States while conducting the Metropolitan Opera? My guess is yes. It's a beautiful tune and a beautiful setting. However, as beautiful as this music is, the last movement can take 25 minutes to perform, and unless this is Philip Glass, we're going to need some contrasting music. Enter a solo bassoon, soon to be followed by its brethren with a suspicious ascending line. Don't worry, they get immediately squashed by the strings. And if things weren't beautiful enough, a horn now joins our beautiful string choir. Thank you. Now the contrabassoon has a go with a contrasting melody, while the violins play eerily in the stratosphere. This combination of extreme low and high is sonically irresistible and has inspired many composers, among them Dmitri Shostakovich. After much beautiful adagioing, a word I just made up, which includes some fantastic climactic moments, though here they are resigned and majestic as opposed to brutal and savage, we arrive at the place beyond. Note how spare the orchestration is. It even looks hollow and non-corporeal on the actual printed page. But once again, this being Mahler, we don't stay here. We return to the adagio and the most intense climax of the movement. The trumpets and trombones enter for the first time, but what follows the climax is just as interesting. Rather than collapse and build back up again, the adagio is unruffled and returns. Now it's time to discuss the final page of this spectacular movement. Mahler marks the tempo adagissimo, the most adagio possible. Conductors have an incredible leeway with these last 27 bars, and the time it takes to perform the music varies considerably from maestro to maestro. The winds are gone, and only the strings remain. Now Mahler quotes from his own Kindertoten Lieder, Songs on the Death of Children. The song he quotes is one of the most beautiful and devastating of this heart-wrenching set, Oft denkt ich, sie sind nur ausgegangen. I often think they have only just gone out, and now they will be coming back home. The day is fine, don't be dismayed, they have just gone for a long walk. Yes, indeed, they have just gone out, and now they're making their way home. Don't be dismayed, the day is fine. They have simply made a journey to yonder heights. They have just gone out ahead of us and will not be thinking of coming home. We go to meet them on yonder heights. In the sunlight, the day is fine on yonder heights. It is so emotionally rending to read these words. It's so much harder to read these words without thinking that they came true for Mahler. Mahler's choice to end the symphony not just quietly, but with the sparest of orchestration, just second violin, viola, and cello, is audacious. Audiences just love loud endings, and no one wants to go home devastated. However, Mahler sticks to his guns, and with four notes on the viola, the symphony and the composer let go and fade away. So at the end of this epic journey, what is indeed great about Mahler's final completed symphony, the Ninth? 1. On a purely musical and technical level, it's a masterpiece. The orchestration is full of great ideas that exploit every possible resource Mahler has. Whether he's using 5 instruments or 50, he knows how to get the most brilliant results. 2. The harmony is at times tonal, at times bitonal, at times atonal, and yet it all works within the grand scheme of Mahler's emotional route that he wishes us to take. 3. The melodic emotional content is remarkable. Whether Mahler writes original tunes, references The Merry Widow, or his own Kindertotenlieder, he is always replete with interesting ideas. Mahler once remarked, "The symphony must be like the world. It must embrace everything. I think the Ninth embraces 2 worlds, this one and the world to come." 3. The journey. This is one of the most profound experiences you can have in Western art. We begin with this epic struggle of life and death and end with acceptance. Leonard Bernstein felt that this symphony's 4 movements were 4 ways in which Mahler bid farewell to this earth. Perhaps the first movement is corporeally, the second a farewell to the countryside and his fellow men, the third a farewell to his critics, and the fourth a spiritual farewell. I remember doing a podcast in what now seems like ages ago, but Mahler's 6th symphony, and quoting the line Handel uses in the aria, "The trumpet shall sound, and we shall be changed." If we are open and informed, and I dare say Mahler does require some openness and study, after listening to this symphony intently, we shall be changed. There is no way we can be the same person before and after this experience. I know I'm not. Mahler always said, "His day will come," and indeed it has. Thanks to great advocates for his music like Leonard Bernstein, Mahler's music is now performed everywhere. Mahler dedicated the 3rd movement of this symphony to his brothers in Apollo. Well, mes petits amis, we are all his brothers in Apollo now. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this has been a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 9.